Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. You're tuned into Life is a Sacred Journey. Every week, we bring a new perspective to aging and caregiving. Here is your host, Michelle Pohl.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are joining us in the virtual neighborhood of Life is a Sacred Journey. I am your host, Michelle Pope, and this is an exciting week for me. Many of you know, and again, I want to thank you all for your birthday salutations and love, and I had a glorious time. I went off the grid, put my phones away somewhere where I couldn't find them until I got back, put my car in the shop, and I went to the beach. And so you can see the hair got salt and sun in it. And I just decided that, you know, I wanted to celebrate my birthday just being thankful and reflecting on this wonderful life that I have been given, the wonderful people like Dr. Pearl who have walked in my life. And when you look at your life that way, my friends, it is glorious. You see little things that bring out glory in your soul. And so I invite you to join me in my 64th year of life, seeking joy, seeking gratitude, seeking knowledge that will help you to grow your best self. Because it's not about anybody else. I don't have to be like any doggone other person on the face of the planet. I just got to be the best me. And Dr. Pearl is being the best him because he's trying to change the trajectory of our conversation around medical care. And I am so excited to have him back today. I'm going to read a little bit of his bio, but I don't want to waste it because it's long. It's long. He's doing so much. And you can always go and see it. But I'm going to read a little bit of it for you so that to remind you about who my friend is. But I also want to say to you, this is a time of change. This is the one revelation that came to me from the Pacific Ocean to you. This is a time of change, dear people. This is not a time, everybody keeps saying, let's return back to the normal. We were not normal, okay? We were just existing as a humanity, bumping into each other, hurting each other. Yeah, we were. And now we have a pandemic that has put us in a place where we've had to reflect about ourselves and how we are crashing into each other, whether it be in the medical field, in the grocery store, or even on the highway. So I am thankful to Dr. Pearl for being here today, and I'm going to read a little bit of his bio. He has become a dear friend. I follow him. I am just so excited. He is one of the people who I have a great deal of love for because when he committed to Life is a Sacred Journey, he really did commit to it. He shares us all over. He and I went viral on TikTok. My daughter called me Dr. Pearl. She's like, did you know that you and Dr. Pearl are viral on TikTok? I said, no.
He had over a quarter of a million people who viewed that conversation. It's great to be so viral with you.
Isn't it? And my 22-year-old daughter, when we get a compliment from her, we've done well, trust me. So let me tell you about my guest. Dr. Robert Pearl is the former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, and that was from 1999 to 2017. And as you all know, that is the nation's largest medical group. And he was also the former and is also the former president of the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group. In these roles, he led 10,000 physicians, 38 staff, and was responsible for the nationally recognized medical care of 5 million Kaiser Permanente members on the West and East Coast. And I'm a Kaiser, we all are, right? Named one of the Marden Healthcare's 50 most influential physician leaders, Dr. Pearl is an advocate for the power of integrated prepaid technology advanced and physician-led healthcare delivery system. And he is, I mean, and I could go on. He serves as a clinical professor of plastic surgery at Stanford University School of Medicine and is on the faculty of the Stanford Graduate School of Business, where he teaches courses on strategy, leadership, and lectures on information technology and healthcare policy. He's the author of Mistreated, which the first time he visited us. We talked about that a lot, why we think we're getting good health care and why we usually are wrong. A Washington Post bestseller and an incredible roadmap. I've sent that book out to some of you, and you received it already. So I hope you're reading it. And then pass it on. Pass it on. And then his next book, which is coming in my mailbox on May 18th, I'm told by Amazon, is Uncaring, How the Culture of Medicine Kills Doctors and Patients. And again, this is what it looks like. This is the cover. And if you buy or purchase your book ahead of time, you will get a wonderful password, and then you can go online and get this, How the Culture of Medicine Kills Doctors and Patients Uncaring. And as I was talking to Dr. Pearl before, those of you who come early heard that. This is what I'm really excited about, because I want you all to start your own online reading groups, and your family can do it as a reading, or if you belong to a Lions group or United Methodist Women's group, you know, I got to plug who I am, and start these groups, start these conversations, because the one thing that I'm realizing, you have to be your own ally when it comes to your medical care as you age in place or for your whole life and the people that you care for. Know what to ask, what to bring into the conversation. And Dr. Pearl talks a lot about that, but he's talking about a culture. And, you know, we talk about culture and systems that are in place that keep things going, right? You know, if you have a system that keeps things going, you have to break that system up. People say dismantle it. I say eradicate, because I think when you dismantle something, you have the possibility of bringing it back together and putting it back together. When you eradicate it, the pieces are all chopped up and you can't bring it back together. So this is what Dr. Pearl is talking about. Dear friend and wonderful, wonderful writer and physician and common good human. That's my new thing. Common good humans. That means you don't just care about yourself. You care about the common good of humanity. And so, Dr. Pearl, welcome again, my friend, to Life is a Sacred Journey. Namaste. It's so good. You can see I'm so happy. I'm so happy to see you.
It's wonderful to be back, Michelle. I really can't wait to engage in discussion with you and have you educate your listeners.
So I want to go to the COVID vaccine and all of that first, Dr. Pearl, because I've been in so many meetings with healthcare professionals as well as public policy folks, and I think they're getting it wrong in the way that they're talking about reopening and what we can and cannot do. And I've been around a lot of people that have the vaccine, and now they're going out and they're not wearing masks. They're engaging in the world in a way as if the pandemic is completely gone and everybody is vaccinated. What is the danger of that, Dr. Pearl?
So let's start with what are the values of the vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cleveland Clinic published this week data that said that 99.7% of people who are dying are unvaccinated.
Okay.
This is opportunity by getting vaccinated to almost completely avoid risk of major disease. And so I want to encourage every viewer and every listener to go out and get vaccinated. Very effective, and the risks are very small.
Okay.
But when you're talking about risks, there's always a risk. When you get in your car, you drive someplace, you could be in an accident. Things can happen, and I don't want anyone to think of ever a guarantee. So I put it onto a scale.
Okay.
What do we know? If you're outside, this is a virus that gets carried through the air, but if the wind is blowing, it gets displaced pretty quickly, and you're not likely to catch it. And because you don't get it from one viral particle. You have to get a large enough mass of it.
Okay.
If you're sitting in an enclosed building without a great ventilation system, with a lot of people, you're safer off if everyone's wearing a mask. That's the spectrum that exists. You're seeing your loved ones for your birthday celebration, and you know that everyone's vaccinated, your chances are extremely extremely small.
Okay.
You go to a concert hall that is filled with people, a lot of people talking, your risks go up. So it's just a question of risk tolerance that's there. But I think the vaccine is now so widely distributed. Over 100 million people have had a dose. If there was going to be a major problem, we would know it today.
Okay.
Very safe. And I would encourage everyone who hasn't had it to please, please, for the sake of the people you love, go out and get vaccinated and make sure you save your own life.
And so what is the herd thing that they're talking about? Will we, so for instance, so there's be a group of people, we'll all be vaccinated, and there will be some people then, if they decide not to, there will be a herd impact where it won't matter? Is that true or false?
It's a great, great, great question.
Mm-hmm.
And your audience is so smart. Let me give them a little bit of second-level science, not just the first level.
Okay.
So for every virus, there's what's called an R-naught. What that says is under regular circumstances, if one person is sick, how many people will become sick as a result of that individual?
Okay.
And for this virus, the R-naught is 3. So one person will give it to 3. Now, think about this. If 2/3 of the people are vaccinated, then statistically,
mm-hmm.
1 in 3 or 2 of those 3 people will now not get sick.
That's right.
As soon as it gets less than 1, that is what's called herd immunity, because at that point, the virus starts to disappear, because one person only gives us a 0.9, 0.9 to 0.8, 0.8 to 0.7, and that's the way it ends. Now, of course, with this virus, there's always something else. And now we're seeing these new mutants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Brazil, India,
yep.
England, and these have an R-naught not of 3, but 5.
Oh, wow.
So rather than needing 2/3 of the people vaccinated, we now need 80% before we start crossing that threshold and the
wow.
virus itself simply can't find enough people to infect. So
okay.
the answer is that the people who don't get vaccinated benefit because the virus disappears. But the more people who are vaccinated, the faster it's going to go away and the safer the people are going to be.
And the ability to travel, you know, that's been my big, you know, I love to travel. I that's what I do in my spare time. But then those individuals may not be able to travel, definitely not outside of the country, but even within our own borders, because then the probability of them bringing the virus with them, either on a plane, train, or automobile, whatever, and then in the places that they go, that then will, so not getting vaccinated really is now becoming, as we move closer and closer to this post-time, is going to be a detriment. It's going to take away the freedoms that many people were complaining about in the very beginning around, you know, wearing a mask and all that. Well, you will then take away your own freedom. Is that right? I mean, does that sound right?
That's true, but I want to raise one more piece that
yeah.
I want to revert to your heart.
Okay.
Which is that the people of color have been criticized.
Yeah.
For being overly vaccine hesitant, for not getting it done. And this week, again, a new study came out that showed that it is socioeconomically driven, not racially or ethnically driven.
Okay.
They're working 2 jobs.
Right.
They can't miss work. They
right.
get fired. They don't have a benefit that allows them to go get that vaccine. And it's not lack of knowledge, education, or anything else. And to me, it is really unfortunate that we've misunderstood, and we should have found other ways. Vaccinated church, several churches coming together. You could have a vaccinated center that would allow a community center. There's so many ways it could have gotten done, And as a nation, we didn't pay attention, and we blamed what I see as the victim for being the cause, rather than recognizing, no, the system was unfair, and we should have made vaccination a mandatory.
Right.
A payday off from work for every worker in this nation if we were serious about getting to herd immunity.
There's two things that Dr. Pearl just said that I want to raise up for you. In our communities, I remember once when I was a child in back in New York, Boston area too, when tooth decay became a major public problem. And what happened was they started sending out these what they call dental buses, vans, whatever you want to call them. I'm going to call it a bus because I was little. And they would give you these purple, came right into your community, gave pamphlets to the parents, and then gave you these purple tablets to see where the decay was, and gave you free dental care to prevent what was happening. What they saw was happening, which was early tooth decay in socioeconomic areas where dental care was not a given, right? Because dental care in many underserved communities is still not a given and leads to all kinds of problems. So that's one. What if we had done that? Where Dr. Pearl is saying, one day in this zip code, we're coming around first for the testing if before we had the vaccine. That would have helped that tremendously. And then once we had the vaccine, come around those same zip code by zip code by zip code, door by freaking door, excuse my language, and given the vaccine to people, then we would have had a record of everybody that was vaccinated, one, and it wouldn't be such a nightmare technology. I know in the state of California, we've got a nightmare of a hodgepodge of systems. We're trying to figure out who got it, who didn't. So Dr. Pearl is saying it's being proactive, but it's not having these grandiose ideas like putting cardboard signs up on these little T things telling people to go and get their COVID shot when there's no transportation in the community to go get the shot. It just doesn't even make any logical sense. And Dr. Pearl, I just want to thank you because everything that you write about, and I've only read the introduction, so don't, friends, I didn't get the book. Dr. Pearl didn't send me the book. I only read the introduction. But also reading his other book, my father would say, the government is a day late and a dollar short. If my dad was alive, that's what he would say. It's like you're thinking about spending all this money, but you could take that same pot of money and impact the community in a medical way. And this could have been, we could have got far further than we are today in this thing. So I just want to push that to you because when you're advocating for stuff and when you're voting for people, have a conversation with them in the future and ask these politicians before you vote for them, what did you do during the pandemic? What was your stand during the pandemic in your community, and what did you do to ensure that your folks, meaning your constituency, got what they needed? Newsletters be damned. I'm sick of newsletters going out to people who don't read them. I found that out myself here at ASAP. My families do not read our newsletter, but if we pick up the phone and talk to them, if we email them or text them, they respond. People don't have time. Dr. Pearl is right. Working two and three jobs, they don't have the time to sit down and read my newsletter unless I point it out to them and say, look, in this newsletter, I have an article from Dr. Pearl, and he's talking about the vaccine. Then they'll read it then, but they're not going to read it if it's just a piece of paper that lands at their house. So I love what you just said, Dr. Pearl, because I do think that we were a day late and a dollar short when it came to providing care and services. The churches did, I know our churches did, take people by the hundreds to these sites. But then for some of our older folks, it was hard for them to stand in line for as long as they had to stand in line. And then when it came to being in the vehicle, it was hard for them to sit as long as some of them had to sit in some of the mass vaccination centers. So you're on point there with that. My next question, though, is about this Pfizer vaccine, and a lot of the young women that I have had conversations with who are very concerned about it, and they're pre-pregnancy or they're of that age where they've heard some side effects that have affected blood clots in younger women and women. Is that still something? I know they took it off for a minute and they put it back on, out in the marketplace. I mean, is that so small still that we should?
Again, let's take the risk. That's what every viewer and listener needs to be doing, is calculating their own risk.
Yep.
So on one hand, what we know is that there is this risk of a terrible problem with a high mortality rate that is rare that happens. But we also know that so far it almost only happens in women relatively young, less than 50, and predominantly less than 40.
Okay.
My belief is that most women in that age group should look for a different vaccine, but that everyone else should be very comfortable with that vaccine. But, again, let me build the risk piece in there. If the chance of even being able to get your second shot of the Moderna or the Pfizer is low, because you can't get 2 days off from work, it's probably a better choice to take a one vaccine dose with the risk than it is to take what will be an inferior outcome from the other. This is the knowledge and the balance that needs to sit in play. But I'd like to go back, if it's okay with you.
No, please. This is you and I as if we were sitting across from dinner. I'm just so thankful that you took the time to come back.
So I want to, get your thoughts on this matter, because it bothered me quite a bit. When we had a shortage of vaccine early on when the vaccine became available, I think we did what made a whole lot of sense, which is we said, who's at highest risk? We vaccinated healthcare workers because they were going to become exposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
We vaccinated people in nursing homes because the conditions were very ripe for rapid transmission. We vaccinated people who were older because we knew their mortality was higher.
Yeah.
And we vaccinated people with chronic diseases. All of that made perfect sense. But we ignored one statistic. African-Americans had a 3 times higher mortality.
Yeah.
Now, if it was 3 times lower, I would have said go to the back of the line. But if it's 3 times higher, why did we not include that statistic in your mind?
Wow.
From our equation? I mean, to me, it's just facts. It's not bias. It's facts, unless you don't follow the facts.
Right.
And now it becomes biased. So, again, I want to throw it to you and say, why? Why did we fail as a nation to include a 3-to-1 ratio? This is not 5% or 10%. This is 300% higher. What's your thoughts about it?
Well, and Dr. Pearl, thank you for that question, because that I was on a panel and somebody asked me, did I feel that the medical system in America, and was America itself as a system, racist? And I was the only person on the panel that said yes. And
what?
Well, and my other colleagues who were not African American took it personal. And this is the issue. They said, "Well, I'm not a racist, and the way I give care is not racist." And I said, "That wasn't the question. The question was, is the system, does it have racism in it? Is it biased?" Yes. And so when you go back to that and you understand that when I went to the doctor, and this is Kaiser, God bless you, Kaiser, and I'm still a Kaiser patient, and when my doctor showed me my chart and it had changed my nationality from African American or black, whatever the heck they called me at that particular time, to white, and it was because they had moved from a paper system to the online system, and my health status looked more like a Caucasian person than it did a black person, and I got inadvertently, my ethnicity got changed. My doctor was very embarrassed by that, but we had a conversation, and I said, "Do you want to know why?" And she said, "Why?" I said, "Do you see diabetes there? Do you see high blood pressure there?" Do you see some of the tip? Okay. And she said, no. I said, but how dare somebody make that decision for me? Because that's what happened. And she was embarrassed. She changed it immediately. But that's a system. That's a systematic thing that comes into the care. And Dr. Pearl, I believe from the bottom of my heart that it is because we have a system that was built on division and separation, and it comes all the way from the top, and it permeates every system that we have developed as humanity, and unfortunately, we're stuck.
Let me engage in a little debate with you.
Please, I'd love this.
I can't wait till people read the chapter in part 4 on racism.
Okay.
It's in the book, Uncaring.
Okay.
And by the way, all the profits go to a charity. I don't make money on it. Doctors Without Borders, a great charity.
Great charity.
And I put that in there that they've done what's called implicit bias research. And the truth is that 2/3 of white physicians have an implicit bias. They're not aware of it.
Okay.
That's why it's called implicit bias.
Okay.
Now, probably if we tested in the reverse, we'd find the same thing that's there, because it's not overt discrimination, the implicit bias. Overt discrimination exists too, but implicit bias for the people on your panel, it happens because if you think back 20,000 years, you're part of a tribe, and a person comes over the horizon, you've got to make a split-second call. Do I shoot an arrow at that person, or do I open my arms and welcome them? Are they part of my tribe, in which case they're bringing back game, or they're someplace else? Our brains are immediately able to do what's called thin slicing,
yes,
and make a determination without us even being aware that it's there. So I would argue that the care is biased. Now, this month, studies came out that said that when a black patient comes to the ED with the same symptoms, in this case, a heart attack,
okay,
the chances of having an interventional procedure are significantly lower when the same white patient comes to the ED with those problems, because it's implicit bias. The doctor's not going to do that extra bit of testing, that extra bit of concern, to spend the extra time that's there. That's what implicit bias is. And it's interesting. I was on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I got asked this question. And I answered that implicit bias is not racism. Knowing it exists and not doing anything about it, that is racism.
And
that's where we are as a nation. Implicit bias is just like being part of humans. But when you know that it exists and you know that it's wrong, now you have an ethical and moral responsibility to do something. And again, that's why I wrote the book, because I think that the medical profession has denied it, and the time has come to recognize it and address it.
So is implicit bias then a construct in which how does it happen? How does it continue to manifest itself? If we're having the discussion and we know it's happening,
you have to go online and get tested for it.
I know. I did.
Basically, looking at the speed of your response to a variety of visual images associated with a variety of words.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take enough time, and in some ways you see two people wearing a white coat, you're going to assume that they are in a healthcare profession and that they're good people.
Yep.
But when one of those people is a black physician and one of those people is a white physician, the white doctor will identify the white physician faster as being good than the black physician. Not because they're intentionally doing that, as soon as it comes to the consciousness. But we're talking about this thin slicing, this immediate response. As I say, I want to let people know, I think it goes back to the tribal period where you had to make this decision in a fraction of a second, or you'd end up being shot by the opposing person coming from a different tribe. So it's just the nature. But it shows itself. We're more empathetic, we're more sympathetic to people who are like us.
Yeah.
They look like us. They're the same skin color. They speak the same language. They worship the same God. And we have to understand that there's something very wrong about that.
Yeah.
And we have to recognize that tendency in ourselves and compensate for it and be aware of it. At the end of that visit in the ED, say, you know, this was a black patient. Is it possible that maybe I had implicit bias and I should have done another test?
Yeah.
Is it possible? I mean, we know that physicians give black patients 40% less pain medication because they think they don't have as much pain. That's
well,
crazy.
We're strong.
Yeah, exactly. So ask ourselves, did I give the same dose? And what are the questions did I treat this patient the way that I would want?
Mm-hmm.
And if
mm-hmm.
I would want 10 milligrams and I only prescribed 6 milligrams, I should say stop myself and say, okay, let me change that medication. If I wouldn't get a stress test, or I'd want it for myself,
wow.
but I didn't
okay.
get it for this patient.
Yeah.
Now, for myself, I didn't want it. Fine. But that, to me, becomes the way you get past this implicit bias by making it very personal about yourself or your parents or your child or your friends or your spouse. It doesn't matter. But that's where I think that we are. I think we're coming to recognize this in terms of a variety of ways that you deal with on your show around society.
Yeah.
This implicit bias is a real factor. And we have to be able to address it, whether it's the Asian American violence we've seen, the Black Lives Matter issues that have come to the fore, issues with Latino and Hispanic type patients, individuals.
Yep.
These are all groups that intrinsically might be seen in quotes as other.
Yep.
And again, if that is what pops up, that's one thing, but not doing anything about it. That is racism.
And that also occurs with our transgender and our LGBTQI. I know I have some friends from that community, and they found that they felt also, you know, we're always talking about oppression, and you know, I'm trying not to get into these wars about am I oppressed more than you're oppressed, you know, and oppression is oppression. Anything that keeps people from living out their full existence to me is oppression. So, but when you start, and this was happening in this conversation I was having with a friend, and I was like, but treating people poorly is treating people poorly. And I don't want to measure, I don't want to be on this scale of measuring whether I feel that oppression affects me worse than it, you know, my transgender friend. But at the end of the day, it's a bigger dialogue. That's what you're talking about. I remember in our first conversation, you made a point of saying, and you just said it again, when you have a conversation or you say something, take a moment first and think about the impact of that. You know, I said something in a meeting once, and I said, chosen lifestyles. And I wasn't thinking that it was a mixed audience with LGBTQIA, and my LGBTQIA friend said, be careful, because that's how they've been described. We've used that word to say chosen lifestyle, which it is not. They don't. That is not true for them. That it's chosen. That it. You know. And so when I said it, it came out of my mouth, and I was just like, uh-oh, that's not what I mean. But I know that's what they heard. And so does this also happen a lot in the medical field, where there's just such a lack of communication in the way that we know that communication that is fruitful manifests itself, where you go in and you're talking with your doctor and you're sharing, but that you're really not communicating. So does this also feed into this whole division between patient and physician?
Another chapter on transgender, and you're making me laugh as I think about some of the issues. You mentioned your electronic health record.
Yep.
So someone comes in, I don't know if I can say it on your show.
You can.
But, they are a woman, but they were born with a penis.
Yep.
All right. Now you go to the electronic health record, and you have to pick between male and female. What do you put in there? And you say, okay, the patient says they're a woman, I'm going to put woman in there. Now in the anatomy description, there's no place to find the word penis. And when you put in the fact that they have a period, now it triggers, the whole system is completely blind and oblivious to the, I'll say, the most superficial components of people who find themselves in that situation.
Wow.
And I talk in the book how uncomfortable that makes quite a number of doctors today, part of the physician culture.
It has to, yeah, it has to be. I mean, even I'm learning, it's, you know, and I don't like putting myself in liberal and that's just, I'm Michelle Pope. But for the rest of the world, as liberal as I and as woke as I think I am, I say things sometimes because I come from the 50s and the 60s where I learned stuff. I didn't, you know, I have a bisexual friend and she's telling me that's not what she is, that there's a whole nother set of category, and I'm like, hold up. When I learned about this, my first exposure, what you're describing to me is bisexuality. But in this modern time, we're dicing things up and we're creating all these new categories. And what I heard from you the last time, Dr. Pearl, is we have to be also patient with each other and be inquisitive. That's the thing that I think that that keeps when people say, Michelle, you have such a young spirit. What that's about is I'm inquisitive about everything. I'm never going to sit back and just be offended by something that somebody said. I'm going to say, excuse me, can we dissect that? Can we tear that apart? Do patients have the right to say to their physician, to their medical providers, hold up, time out, dice this up for me, talk to me. Do they have that right?
Absolutely, they have the right. But there's a piece that I wrote in Forbes that you'd be interested in last week, and it was called, it came from in my monthly newsletter that you've now subscribed to.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank
I
you.
Saw that today. I ask readers for stories about physician culture.
Oh.
And one doctor wrote to me about the experience that he had as a resident, where in the evening the doctors get together to hand off the care from the daytime to the nighttime,
mm-hmm.
because it's a 24-hour requirement for care. And sometimes people would say, good patient, bad disease. Now, it's true. Yeah, there are a lot of good patients. You know, you have someone, a young mom who gets metastatic breast cancer with a couple of young kids. That's a really good patient with a bad disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a lot of other individuals. But how often that phraseology ends up being a good patient is someone who looks like me, has my education, speaks my language, worships in my particular church, synagogue, mosque, whatever it's going to be, and how often the language of medicine is something that promotes some of the problems that are there,
yeah.
And how often would we label someone very different from ourselves, whether it's someone who's transgender, whether it's someone mm-hmm. who has a different category of sexual
mm-hmm.
belief or self-description in the good category with ourselves. That, to me, again, is a major part of the, I don't know, racism, sexism, all the isms that are out there. And I think it's, again, built into the physician culture, the culture of medicine, where phrases like that are said, everyone sort of understands, but no one calls out what's going on.
So what changed it for you, Dr. Pearl? Why? I mean, you're definitely going down a different rabbit hole. And so what was that moment for you where you said, I see this and I can't be a part of it and I have to be the change? So what made that happen?
Yeah, so I would say there were two aspects on a temporal basis. First, I had remarkably wonderful parents. They were very, very welcoming. In fact, that's what they were known for, because they would take everyone inside their tent. It didn't matter who they were. Everyone else was battling with each other. Everyone else was yelling at someone. And they were the ones that said, let's come, you know, we're all family. We're all friends. We're all community, whatever else was going to be. So that was my general tendency, my proclivity growing up.
Okay.
You know, again, they talk about it in the book. My early years in medicine, I just loved it. I couldn't see any of the problems that were there. Now, remember, I was a medical student. I was a resident. You know, I finished medical school. I was only 25. So really idealistic times that were sitting there.
Yeah.
So all those pieces being there. And then I just encountered it. I encountered it, and I talk in the book about some negative experiences I saw as a medical student, as a resident. And when they happen in enough times, they just wear away at you. And that's what I would say. I don't think there was any one thing that led me there. To a certain extent, I think over time, having been the CEO and seeing how many people outside of Kaiser Permanente, Kaiser Permanente is not perfect. And
I don't say
it's the system.
Right.
But the structure of doctors and patients working together, a system that is driven by value and not driven by volume, an ability to worry about patients from a variety of backgrounds, all of those pieces started to become very visible and led me to write my first book. And then when, you know, once you write a book, you hear from a lot of folks.
Yeah.
I say, you know, I get a lot of messages. And when the stories start being similar, stories like the one you described earlier, where you know your race gets put down wrong inside a medical record, even knowing that the intent isn't there.
Right.
They're good people, but bad things happen. Now it starts to bother me, and I start to see the problems that are there, write about the problems that are there, and then wonderful people like you invite me to your show, and audience grows, and... I think it's more of an evolution than a revolution in my experience.
Okay.
Although, again, I think my father's death did trigger something in my mind that led me to say there is something broken about the system when a man who is so wonderful dies of a medical error, despite having two sons who are doctors and a daughter who's a healthcare leader. There's something very wrong in that system, and it needs to change. And then out of that, coming across the fact that it's not just the system, it's the culture, and that's the second book, that too has to change. It's just the right thing to do. And I think most people want to do the right thing, and you and I have the privilege of having a bit more information than many people, so we can write about or speak about the kinds of right things, because we've been fortunate to be put in that situation to get that information and to share it with others.
And how have your colleagues received your... I know the Mistreated book and Uncaring's not out yet, but how have they received your culture change in because you're really talking about a culture change within the medical system that we've all talked about for decades, but this is different. This is starting with the core. You know, I like circles instead of squares because circles are wonderful, but it's that for the patient or the person that is in the middle, and everybody's moving closer and closer to the person, therefore there's more connectionality or connectivity among folks. But, you know, that piece is so important. And so how in the culture are you exchanging that with the books are one thing, but also in the trajectory of the meeting room and in that emergency department and all of that. I mean, are you seeing that folks are beginning to have that culture change?
Well, we'll see. Remember, as you said, the book doesn't come out till next Tuesday. You will pre-order the book and read the introductory chapter. You still have the other chapters to go. But I did worry before Mistreated because I was attacking the system of medicine.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, my colleagues were very supportive. In fact, that's what really led to this understanding of culture. You know, I think the part of the issue to me in medicine is that for so long, there was so little that doctors could do. I mean, remember, it wasn't until the middle of the 1900s when penicillin came along and actually physicians extended life on average compared to not intervening. We're talking about medicine goes back 5,000 years.
Right.
You know, and think about being a doctor before you had the tools and a child is dying in front of you. That's horrific.
Horrific.
And so we developed denial and repression as powerful ways to deal with the circumstances, or doctors would have gone crazy. They are, by the way, going a little bit, I don't know, not really crazy. They're getting depressed and burned out and PTSD over the COVID.
Yeah.
Because they face the same thing. I had one doctor tell me he lost 4 patients in a single day. Imagine that. Here you are a healer, and you haven't lost 4 patients in a year, and now 4 of them die in a single day, the consequences of doing that. But it's that repression and that denial that are there. But as you know, repression and denial, it's not a solid container. It's like a fine-grained sieve that the emotion slowly leaks out.
Yep.
If it's slow enough, we can get rid of it.
Yep.
Why the flu deaths in one day were so overwhelming. They know at some level the things that they're doing need to get better. Not to get rid of. At the end of the book, in the end I say, you know, what we have to do is figure out how we can retain the parts that are wonderful.
Yeah.
That led the doctors to go to the hospital in the face of COVID.
Yeah.
To deliver the care, putting their own life at risk. I mean, how much more wonderful can you get? Doctors who go internationally, I think in the last show I talked about the physician who went to Liberia to take care of people with Ebola and had to get IVs in his arms and came back totally excited and thrilled with the practice of medicine. We can't lose those things.
No.
But we've got to recognize the ways that we don't focus enough on prevention, that we're too concerned with hierarchy, where we do engage in racism and sexism and all the other isms that are out there. We just need to acknowledge it and break through. And I'm hoping that this book maybe will be a tool that will allow people to accept the fact that it doesn't mean they're a bad person.
Right, yeah.
They just need to take action again. You're not a racist from my perspective. You're more of an expert than I am, but I would say you're not a racist for having implicit bias. You are. When you know that it exists and you don't take action to correct it. And I think that that's what I'm hoping we're going to do in healthcare and as well as in a lot of other places in society. We've uncovered the problem and now it's just not covered back up.
Thank you.
And to change it and to evolve it and transform it.
Yes, Dr. Pearl. And you know, I love that because I just heard something the other day that there's a reason that the rearview mirror is so small and the windshield is bigger. And I thought that was perfect, right? I wrote that down because that's it. It's like you look back, yes, you do, but it's a tiny vision. But we need that windshield vision now moving forward. And we also need to stop pointing finger. I love what you just said because I believe we're all victims of thoughts, ideas, things that we've been exposed to that manifest themselves. That, you know, I keep saying I have tapes that keep playing. And I have to be strong. I have to go, whoa, 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 whoa. But it's that self-talk that gets me out of that because if not, I would not be able to show up in the world as the loving, caring person that I'm trying to be. I, you know, because I have some tapes that are not good that play when certain things happen and I have to look at myself and then look at the individual that hit that replay button or rewind button and make the determination it's not about them, right? It's not about them. And so, but that's a lot of work, Dr. Pearl. I have to tell you, that manifestation of that those moments take a lot out of me, but it is people like yourself and other folks that I've read and everything that I realized the change had to be within me, you know?
Absolutely agree. It takes a lot to face the reality, to look in the mirror, but I'll also say that once you've done that, I think you end up feeling a lot better. I think when you go, again, I go back to that question, did you treat every patient you encountered today as you would want for yourself and your loved ones, your friends and your family, and being able to look in that mirror and truly say yes, I think lets you sleep better at night and wake up the next morning more refreshed. I think a lot, and as a, you know, one of the major parts of the book is about physician burnout.
I see this,
and I think a major part of that is the loss of mission and purpose, some of which has been done to doctors. They call it moral injury by insurance companies, by computer designers, by regulators. We can point fingers at all the things that have been done to us inside medicine. But I also think we need to be willing to pull back the veil and see the things that we do to ourselves.
Yeah.
Because if we don't do that, I think that change won't happen. And that's something I often say to people in the medical world. You know, we've been yelling about burnout for 5 years. What's different today? If nothing's going to change, then yelling louder isn't going to make it happen. You've got to do something else to take action. You know, I think we've seen it recently in some of the police issues with people of color. And I think action may start to be happening, but as you and I talked about before the show, you need a critical mass.
Yeah.
You need about 30% of people all wanting to see change happen, and then it starts to occur. And at least in the medical world, when it comes to the physician culture, we're still not there. I'm hoping that we will get there. We'll see how the doctors respond to the book once they have the chance to read it. I'll be interested in seeing how you respond.
I can't wait to read all of it. Yeah. Will we get better? Will you know, I'm thinking right now of you know, Malcolm X said, you know, how did he say it? I, illness, we, wellness. Will there come a time where wellness, how do I want to say this? If we become and we follow some of this conversation that you and I have now had twice, and we begin to take those baby steps, will we begin to see a system that is more focused on wellness, meaning mind, body, and spirit, but then able to handle the illness when it occurs in a very different way? Because when I'm in partnership, you know, Dr. Pearl, if you were my physician when I had cancer, you and I were in partnership. We would have been in partnership. And I got better, I think, because of this, along with the medical. But we were together, this particular physician that I had at Kaiser, she and I fought together. She took the piece that I have no knowledge of, what was going on inside, and I took the mind, body, the mind and spirit, and we worked together. And I thought that is why, you know, yes, it was stage two and all, I mean, all the science stuff was in my favor. But what I'm saying is the trajectory of wellness felt quicker for me than I've seen for other people. And I'm not saying I'm magic. That's not it. It was just that I went into it with the doctor as my partner. Does that change everything? If you just go in and, my mechanic is my partner too. But do you know what I'm saying? We take care of our cars. That's an example. I just spent $1,100 on my Acura getting it all dutied up for this year. I take it in there a lot to make sure that it runs for me. I know more about that car probably than I know about my own system. But I partner with my mechanic to make sure that it runs because I'm not buying another car. Is that the same? Why can't we get there, have that marriage, physician and patient, and we come into it with the understanding we're partnering with our physicians so they're not heavy loading, you know, waiting for us to come in only when the brakes are bad. Did that make sense? I went all around the grandfather's barn.
Cool sense, and actually there's a lot of research confirming everything you just said.
Okay.
So there's a huge amount of research that indicates how your psychological well-being, contributes to getting better physically, recovering from disease. There's a lot of information about good diet, exercise, relieving stress. There's tremendous literature on all the points that you're making. So now the question you're posing after that is, okay, if there's all this science out there, why do so few doctors? There's none, as you said, you had a great doctor.
No, I had a great doctor.
Why do so few doctors do it? And I'll come back to the same thing. I feel like a little bit of a broken record.
I know.
It's the culture. Because in the physician culture, number one, doctors just don't value the things like that. Why is that? They trained for 10 years. They're going to value the things they did for 10 years.
Mm.
Number two, in the culture, it's a patriarchal hierarchical, and the patient is at the bottom. And that's a nice thing. And if you could bring, your mechanic could force you to bring your car in, he could do whatever he wanted on the car, and you'd have to pay the bill. He might like that system more than the one that exists right now, but it's not what you want
no.
as the car owner.
That's right.
The real question is, will medicine move to respecting the consumer more? The whole, again, a whole chapter on why that's not what doctors in general want. There are exceptions and they're wonderful.
Yeah.
But it is what patients want, particularly now. This is the evolution that has happened across time. You know, there's the internet. There are cell phones. There's tremendous amount of knowledge. There's misknowledge too. But patients want something different right now. Doctors don't seem very interested in giving it to them. And now when you ask the question, it gets back to 30%. Think about telemedicine.
Yes.
It's a really great example. You know, 7 years ago, I was writing about the fact that 14 million virtual visits would be done in Kaiser Permanente.
Wow.
And I was predicting that 30% of what doctors do in their offices across the United States today would be done virtually. And for 6.5 years, nothing happened. Nothing. I mean, 1, 2%, 3%. That was it.
And here we go.
Then it comes along. And what happened? It soars to 60 to 70%. Why? Because doctors have to minimize spread of disease. They don't. They and their staff don't want to get COVID.
That's right.
They have to close their office, and now they are going to offer telemedicine. Now, there are other pieces, too, having to do with reimbursement and regulation. But the question is, what's going to happen in the post-coronavirus era? And it's interesting to me, again, in the culture of medicine, you know, once you sort of have this lens, you look very closely for it.
Yeah.
I have yet to see any documented examples of where patients got harmed overall. I mean, there's always things that go wrong.
Yeah.
But if you compare 1,000 people being told, call your doctor, make an appointment, go to the office, and you offer 1,000 people an immediate telemedicine with a physician who wants to do it, when you compare these two groups, I think you get better quality,
yeah,
easier access, and a lower cost with telemedicine. Doctors never did it before. Why is that? It just doesn't fit with the culture.
No, yeah.
Like the office. I mean, imagine that. We call it a waiting room. You have to wait on me.
Right.
What an interesting, you know, when you think about culture, it's about the stories and the language. You know, we don't call it a reception room. We don't call it a welcoming room. It's a waiting room. And that's what doctors have in every office of the United States today.
Oh, my gosh. Dr. Pearl, you know, you have to come back more often. We're going to have Dr. Pearl come back on a continuous basis because, one, I like talking to him. And number two, I know that you are enjoying this conversation because it's opening up your minds, and that's all this is about. I'm not an expert on anything. I'm just an expert on living my life. I don't know anything else. But
you're an expert on people, yeah, and you have a broad range of individuals that you come across and interact with. No, seriously.
Thank you, Dr. Pearl.
I do learn a tremendous amount. I think about our conversations when I listen to them or see them once they're
once, yeah, once the Alicia does her work on them.
But
she does great work, yes. I want to thank you, Dr. Pearl, because I am looking forward to reading the book. I want to thank you, too, for your courage because, and I think I said this after you and I spoke the first time on the following week when I do my own ponderings. It takes courage to speak our truth. And I think that a lot of times people, somebody said this to me a couple of days ago. They said, oh, it's easy for you because you're a strong black woman. And I thought, ah, man, they don't realize, no, it's not that easy because I have to put myself out there. You have to be authentic. You have to put yourself out there. You have to live your truth. You have to show up for people when you share your thoughts and your ideas. So I want to thank you for being that courageous person, as well as to talk about, you know, racism and implicit bias in a way that really helps us to understand the victimization, not just on the folks that feel it, but the folks that are living in it without any knowledge of, you know, that it's manifesting itself in word and deed and all of that. And, you know, that's something that I think that we all can take away and understand that, you know, not everybody that's out there, yes, the people that are burning crosses and throwing rocks and doing weirdness, that's a group of people. But other people who are out there, sometimes you just have to tell them. You know, and it's just like I had to say to this person, you know, when you say you're just a strong black woman, you know that's a stereotype, right? You know that you just said something very stereotypical to me, and it's not true. You know, it's not true. How many hours has Michelle Pope spent alone crying or worrying about something? That's stuff that you don't see. You just see how I come out of the house all revived and new and fresh, but we take stuff into the darkness of our homes in order to come out and speak our truth. So I want to thank you, Dr. Pearl, for your books because they are wisdom, circles of knowledge that you take the science, you take the language, and you make it so that people can understand. I want to thank you for Uncaring, the introduction. You can purchase it, and then you'll get some of this pre-stuff. And a code, it'll come right to you. And Dr. Pearl warned me that it would go in my spam. Thank you for that. And then you'll get this reading, and this I'm going to push on you, even afterwards, when you get the book, any group that you belong to, this is a good conversation to have. You don't have to be a physician or a healthcare provider or a nonprofit organization. You're a human being living in this world. And if we want to change the world, we have to take in knowledge about the places that we want the change to happen. Medicine, education, housing. These basic things, if we want these basic things to change, we have to educate ourselves, have discussion, and then go back out into the community and figure out what the common good needs, okay? All right, so that's what Dr. Pearl brings to us when he writes his books. That's when he's sitting down, pecking away at his computer, trying to figure out how to bring all this to you. That's what Mistreated is about. That's what Uncaring is about. And we're going to have a book study. That's what I'm going to do for you guys. Okay? You hearing me? Get the book. I'll give you some time to read it because I'm a fast read, you know, because that's all I do is read. I don't watch television very little. And we'll have a book study on Michelle Pope Productions, and we'll talk about this because I think this is important. And I also see this format being a place that you can have conversation about other things, Dr. Pearl, because you don't just your books cross the places where things intertwine. So we are able to do that, and maybe I'll bring Dr. Pearl in as our guest during our book study. So I get Uncaring. It's coming. Mine's coming on the 18th. I'll show it to you in its flesh. When I get it, and you know how I do books, it'll have post-it notes all through it, and I'll show you what I thought was wonderful, and then you can tell us what you thought was wonderful. But Dr. Pearl, before I let you go, give us, so we're going to get through this pandemic, We are, because that's what we are built that way. Humans are built that way. But are we preparing ourselves for something else? Will there be another pandemic or something that, is this the last one? No.
Yeah, there's going to be many, many more viral infections and maybe other things medically relevant as well. It's just the nature of the evolving world. I mean, for everything that's good, there's a bad, and
yeah.
As we've grown the population, there are negative things that are happening, as you know, right?
Yeah.
Climate.
Yeah.
And this kind of transmission of disease from the animal world to the human world can become more common, particularly as we do devastation in Brazil and in parts of Africa.
Right. Yeah.
This is going to be an inevitability. This is just the survival of the fittest. But what I would say is that we have a choice. Mm-hmm. As you said so beautifully, going back to the old normal is not the destination we should be looking for.
Yeah.
And we can either decide that we're going to create our future, our destiny, or someone else is going to do it for us.
Mm-hmm.
One of those two things is going to happen. And like yourself, you and I are both believers.
Yep.
It's better to be driving the car than being dragged along behind it. So that's the opportunity. And for any viewers and listeners who are still worried, I wrote the book for the patient in all of us.
Mm.
The patient in all of us. Whether you're someone who today is getting care or giving care, because tomorrow you can be someone on the other side of the stethoscope, if you want to think about it that way. And so it was really written to help educate that. And then I love your notion around the discussion groups, because that's the way ideas get spread.
Yep.
I'm offering a starting point, but I'm sure your viewers, listeners will come up with far better ideas and insights, particularly as they apply their backgrounds
mm-hmm.
to the situations that are there. You know, it's interesting in the book, when I talk about some of the racism, I ask the question, who's more likely to notice that we under-tested black patients in the ED, a black physician or a white physician? Not because they're bad or better or worse,
mm-hmm.
because that's just this notion of who we are
yep.
as people.
Yep.
We can try to pretend that it doesn't exist. We're not going to ever truly get rid of it.
No.
But we need to be getting rid of the consequences, which is that as a result of that, we don't have the empathy, the sympathy, the understanding for each other. That would make our world a far better place. And any of your viewers and listeners who have their own discussion group, please let me know how it went.
Yeah, we will. We will.
Discussion guide. I'll update your discussion guide. So
yeah.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Well,
you
Dr. Pearl.
Energy and enthusiasm and optimism for the future. I can't wait to be back with you sometime. Whenever you want to have it.
Well, and we will, because I want to read the book again, and I want to give readers, and when we have Dr. Pearl back, we will do more of a Q&A with you. I want you to read the book and raise up questions that come up for you. And then when Dr. Pearl comes back, maybe at the end of the summer, we will pose those questions. I want to thank Dr. Pearl because he has become a dear friend. I am following him. I will be stalking him forever in friendship. And I'm just excited to know that there's somebody out there. You know, everybody that comes to Life is a Sacred Journey, what I realize is that we have created a format that there are people out there that knows when love shows up. When love shows up, you guys, the world is an amazing place. It is an amazing place when love shows up. It creates warmth. It creates opportunity. It creates things like uncaring. It creates this because you can't just keep it to yourself. So, Dr. Pearl, thank you so much for joining us again on Life is a Sacred Journey. Thank you for your work, everything that you do, for your voice, for your courage, and for your friendship. It means a great deal to me. And so all of you out there in Life is a Sacred Journey land, go to Dr. Pearl's website. You'll see much more information. He has his musings. He has all kinds of things that you can, you know, learn more about and help to create dialogue for yourself or ask questions for yourself. And share the book, share the interview, pass it on, and have a wonderful weekend with your family and friends. Happy belated Mother's Day to all the mothers out there and the mothers who were mentors who didn't give birth, but you mothered somebody who, you know, Dr. Pearl's mother talked about his mother and his father and how they made their tent big. Make your tent big. Open your arms wide for the humanity, because together, Dr. Pearl and I didn't even know each other. We didn't even, check this out, we didn't even know each other a year ago, 14 months ago. The pandemic brought us together. And Southwest Airlines, because I was reading something and his name came up. Do you see how the world works? We can change this earth. We don't even have to know each other, but we can change it. So, Dr. Pearl, thank you for being the change you want to see in the world. And thank all of you at Life is the Sacred Journey audience. And have a great weekend. Dr. Pearl, stay there for 1 second. Have a great weekend, my friends. Well, be good to yourself, because you only get to go around one time. This person. You may come back as something else, but this person, this is it. Okay? Have a good weekend. Be blessed. Let me get rid of that. All right. Thank you. You are amazing, as always. You are amazing. It's so much fun. I could talk to you for hours. You know, I'm one of those kind of people. I went to dinner with a friend the other night, and we closed the restaurant out. It was the first time we had been together. And it wasn't about the food. It was just we talked about everything, you know, and I just love that kind of energy. I just love life, you know. Life is meant to be lived, and I think I told her having cancer helped that quite a bit. You know, I don't know how else to say it. You know, after that happened, I was just like, am I living my best life? I thought I was. I still think I was, but I live it a little bit differently now, you know, where, like you said, taking that break to love yourself, caring for other people even when they don't even know you is so important to my soul now. Yeah.
That's great. Well,
yeah.
You're an amazing interviewer, amazing person. So
let's stay in touch. Let's stay in touch. You're good. And then when we can get together, we can go out to dinner and have one of those close the restaurant dinners also.
There you go.
Okay. All right.
Let me know when you're going to post this.
Yeah, I'll let Felicia's going to let you know when it's going
to
go up.
To the robertpearlmd.com.
Okay.
I didn't say anything about it, but so people can know where to go. The website.
Okay.
The website.
I'll have her
address. And I'm sure she can put it on her screen.
She'll put it on as a banner.
The banner or something.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
All right, Dr. Pearl, have a great weekend.
You too. Have a great time, and thank you for having me back. It's been too much fun.
Always. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Oh, man. Oh, he's so magnificent. Oh, my God. You're a great interviewer. My friend. Hello, I was just ending my thingy. I'm sorry when I called you.
No. Okay. When you were talking and it crossed my mind right when you were saying and you said, because you had a conversation with somebody and they said, oh, Michelle, you know, I'm just so basically envious or admire you because you're a strong black woman. And I thought about that for a moment and I said, you know what? That used to be the thing that, you know, people with stereotypes, or they stereotype the
Yeah, and that's what they turned that into. That's what I was trying to tell her. You can't say that to me because that you're basically saying I get noticed because I'm loud or I'm black, a big black, you know. Yeah. That's not me.
I'm in charge now, so I'm gonna F you up.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they hate
men. Girl.
Because that spirit hates men.
And you can see, Dr. Pearl and I love each other. Felicia wrote me a little note. She said, "You and Dr. Pearl are flirting." I said, "I know." He lives half-time in San Francisco, Santa Clara area, and half-time in New York.
Oh, okay.
Because he's from, you can hear that New York accent. He's from there. But a very powerful man, and he's like, I mean, he just adores me. Yes! Don't be calling. She had no idea what she was saying, and it's unfortunate because she was white. You know what I mean? That makes it even worse.
That's what was considered for a while there. Black women had to be like that. But you know what? I think that's another thing that was perpetrated on the black race by the white slave master people and after that because they destroyed the men. And now look at it.
Yep.
They're even trying to destroy white men.
Yep.
They making everybody feminine. When was the last time that anybody got elected to a political office, be they white or black, and especially black and Hispanic, because they're saying there's no diversity with people of color, but yet they get an angry black or Hispanic woman.
Right. Right.
Where are the men?
Right. Well, I was so happy when he agreed with me on that because that's not a label, and I know she was trying to give me a compliment, and that's the other side of it. She wasn't trying to offend me. She was trying to give me a compliment, but it's like that's a bad compliment.
Bad people aren't, as the new word, they aren't woke to what that really means.
Right.
And what that represents.
Right.
Strong, black